Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander. Once again, I would like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. And today we have joining our program, once again, is Alan Mackey. Alan is a regular on our program. He shares a lot of information that is very relevant to the left. And today we're going to be talking about much of Alan's career as an activist, as a peace activist, working to protect workers' rights. And the title for our program and discussion today is The Fight for Workers' Rights. And Alan, once again, I would like to thank you for joining the program today.
Well, thanks for having me again, Stuart.
Alan, you're welcome. Alan, your career as a peace activist, as a community activist, civil rights activist, I mean, you have really been out there protecting workers' rights for well over a half a century. And myself personally, I would like to thank you for that. You were doing that some 30 years before I came on board, but you've been very involved. Alan, what, if you can share just for a little bit, what got you involved? What was it back in, you say it was in 1963 that you got involved as a activist protecting human rights? And what was it that took place then that made you decide that you wanted to go into a different direction from much of that, much of the information that you received while you were there in elementary school and high school? What happened then?
Well, I guess for me, it's been sort of easy coming into the left because my parents and grandparents are all involved in left-wing activities in the Communist Party. My first introduction really to, you might say, politics came at a young age, because I was in a group called the Interracial Youth Council of Grand Rapids. That was in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And actually, it was sort of a child care organization, you might say. But from that, I went into the NAACP Youth Council, and I joined the Communist Party in late 1963 as our high school was being integrated. We were the Union High School I went to was the first high school in Michigan that was integrated. And it was the Interracial Youth Club and the NAACP Youth Council that sort of spearheaded this activity among the students while the adults pressed the lawsuits against the Board of Education. And it was a successful lawsuit. The court ordered the schools integrated, but there was a lot of violence that came along with that. The Ku Klux Klan was very active. The head of the Grand Rapids, Michigan Police Department admitted that he was a member of the John Birch Society. And a couple city officials admitted they were members of the John Birch Society. So it was a very violent integration. And a lot of people don't think of integration in the North as being violent, but it was very violent. Kids were beat up. The police beat students, black students and white students that supported them with billy clubs and maced them and threw them in jail. And I was one of those that went to jail. I was sentenced to 7 years in prison, and that was eventually overturned. But
How old were you at that time?
When the integration suits first started, I was just turning 13, late 1963. I was actually 12 years old.
You were 13 years old, and they were ready to sentence you to 7 years in prison?
Well, that came later. That was in when I was 17 years old. In 1968, I was actually sentenced. That's when the so-called police riots and everything started, when the school was actually, the integration took place. The integration movement took place over about, from about 1963 through 1967 and 68. So it was quite a long, protracted, drawn-out affair going through the courts and everything until finally the judge ordered the schools to be desegregated and busing and everything to integrate the schools. I just have a thing right here I can read to you. It's a brief statement from the head of the superintendent of police in Grand Rapids, Michigan, because it, I think it's important not only because of what was done to me, but because of what was done to so many other people, and because what can be done with these records that the government is keeping today. And this is labeled restricted. It came through the FBI files that I received as a result of a court decision. It says, "Dear Dick, Bill Pettiford turned this report over to me to get your information. Telephone number 245-1995 is listed to Robert E. LeBaron of 504 Umatilla Southeast. I can find nothing on Mr. LeBaron. However, it might be of some interest to know that he lives in the Negro area. He apparently is the publisher and publishes this paper in his home. Telephone number 453-3668 is listed to Armas I. Mackey of 1854 Street Northwest. Alan Mackey, 17 years, is the son of Armas and lives in the same address. Alan is known to our people to be the youngest known card-carrying communist in Grand Rapids. He is one of the young men who gave us so much trouble at Union High School. I trust this will answer your questions. If I can be of further help, please let me know. Sincerely, William A. Johnson, Superintendent of Police, Walter A.
Wow.
Gilbert, Inspector of Detectives." So this, I have in my possession over 10,000 pages from these FBI files. And, you know, these files show what the police have done, the FBI have done. They've had these red squads, and they've hounded and harassed people. I mean, even youth, you know, they've done this too. And, you know, they did this in the Occupy movement, and it continues today. And, you know, we got to be aware of this because this is a, you know, threat to our so-called democracy.
Right. Alan, let me ask you, when you were involved at those young age, at that young age, was there any type of violence that was associated with that? Where you, when you were on the front lines, I know you were arrested several times, but was there any type of violence between you and the police at that time?
Well, at one time the police broke my nose and they broke my hip. I was in the hospital.
And broke your
hip. Broken
hip.
Yeah, five big cops jumped on me. This was during the integration of Union High School. I was writing down badge numbers of the cops that were beating up black students. As the black students got off the bus, the cops joined these racist mobs that were beating the black kids with baseball bats. Some of the kids came out of the high school, the white racists came out of the high school with baseball bats wearing football helmets, and it was just a bloody mess. And while I was writing down badge numbers, the police jumped on me and they charged me with assault and resisting arrest. And I was just lucky. I was one of the lucky ones because the TV cameras were on this action. And I was convicted by a very racist judge. And I was lucky I had a good lawyer, Alphonse Lewis, who was a human rights activist his entire life. He's dead now. But he fought it through and appealed the case after I was convicted. Several of the black students actually served time in the state prison. And after the movies were shown that the news media had, they were released from prison. But they were, including a pregnant, young pregnant girl, she was 18 years old. She was sentenced to, I think it was 5 years in the state prison, and she actually started serving time. Yeah, and, you know, very racist right from the police department to the, you know, a lot of the people in the community. Eventually we got a lot of the kids together in interracial organizations in the school, and that helped to, you know, to make the busing successful for integration. But it was a very violent mess.
How were you received, you know, today, if you say that you're a communist or socialist, I find people, you know, you're received quite well. Back then you were not. Now if you say you believe in capitalism, people sort of frown on that, you know, because they have seen the direction that capitalism has taken this economy and the direction it has taken working people. But how were you received as a communist when you were out in public back in the early 60s? You were taught, and you know, your thoughts were, you know, being a communist, you know, you demonize even the thought of someone being a communist. But
I wasn't really an open communist at that young age. I was in my involvement was in the civil rights organizations like the Interracial Youth Councils and the NAACP. I didn't really, really become an open communist until around 1967 or 68. And in 1972, I ran on the Communist Party ticket for Congress against Gerald Ford. And that made me a very open communist and a target by the police and the FBI. But,
now,
you know, I've, the jobs I've worked at in the factories and stuff, I've never really had a problem with people. People wondered, well, why are you a communist? And I'd explain it to them, and some people would agree, some people would disagree, but it was very friendly. Most of the opposition came from, you know, management people, and then from the police and the FBI and some of these real right-wing groups like the John Birch Society and the KKK. And now we got this outfit run by this billionaire Richard Mellon Scaife called KeyWiki, and he's attacking thousands of people across this country, including myself. And, you know, these right-wing groups, this is the way they act. And the police allow these and encourage these right-wing groups to act in this way. And these right-wing groups, actually, they become to think that they have the right to do anything they want to people and they can get away with it. In the late 80s, my children were shot at by the Michigan militia after I wrote an article attacking Ronald Reagan and his policies. They were actually shot at by five guys with shotguns. We were just lucky they didn't stand still long enough to get good, accurate shots, and all the shotgun pellets tore into the top of our house. But the police actually caught these culprits. The Michigan State Police caught them, and they let them go. And about 3 or 4 years later, the Michigan State Police had a shootout with the same group of the Michigan militia, and one of the Michigan militia was killed by the police, and one cop was killed, and one cop was wounded. So, you know, and that was the same cops that let these guys go when they attacked my kids. They, in fact, they thought it was funny. They attributed it to left-wing versus right-wing violence. I said, where's the left-wing violence? And the cop said, well, there's some people that don't like the things that you say and what you write. I says, well, that's not violent. You know, it's, violence is when my kids are shot at right now. And, you know, it was a terrible situation, and eventually we had to move to Canada because it got so bad.
Let me ask you, Alan, we could see a lot that was taking place with the civil rights movement and what was taking place especially there in the North. People thought, our thinking was that the violence with police and blacks and, you know, the segregation and all that was just restricted, you know, was limited to the areas of the South, but we could see that it was right there in the North also. In many of the northern states, including Illinois, it was there in parts of Ohio, even throughout some of the New England states like Massachusetts and like that. How you could see what was taking place with Martin Luther King as he was on the front lines, and obviously you on the front lines also. How were you viewed as far as your position taking a stand for many of the minorities and blacks around that time in many of the northern areas where you were that you had spent time in?
Well, like I say, I think that most people found that, you know, our activities were they considered these activities good. Well, you know, it was a very small handful of very right-wing reactionaries that opposed it and whipped up this racist and very violent sentiment.
But
and,
the majority of the people supported you.
Yeah. When I was arrested, I've been arrested over 65 times now, including a couple times in Canada, for my political activities. And when they tried to draft me, they jailed me, and the massive outpouring from people all over the country was just like you wouldn't believe it. People just rallied to my defense. When I was arrested in Grand Rapids during the integration of Union High School, hundreds of people signed petitions demanding that they drop the charges against me and the other students that were arrested. So, you know, and this is not just people in the black community, but people in the white community. And a lot of white people are afraid to say anything against racism because these right-wing hate groups target them so quickly because they want to smash any kind of chance for unity between peoples. And I think this is important for people to understand that most people are fairly decent people, I find. And if they see an injustice, they're going to speak out against it or at least try and support
right.
people that are doing something against these injustices. The injustice has to be explained. It took us 5 years to explain why it was necessary to integrate Union High School. A lot of people didn't understand that at first because of the there were racist covenants in the real estate transactions and everything where it said you cannot use, if you bought a house, it said in the deeds you could not sell your home to a black person or a person of color. And so
right.
there was all this. We lived in a white neighborhood, and there wasn't a single black person living in the neighborhood until about 10 years ago, and it was because of the integration of Union High School that the community is finally integrated. For the first time, the west side of Grand Rapids has become integrated. And,
right.
I think integration is important because one thing, people said, why do you fight for integration? Why do we have to have this in our school? And we would try to explain to them that, what good is an education if kids aren't at least being taught respect for all peoples? And
right.
people began to understand that. But it was a big struggle, it went on for years. And now everything is sort of like normal with the integration of Union High School. People just take it for granted. Now that's like 40 years later,
Well,
and white kids go to school in peace.
And a lot of people can't understand what segregation, what it's like. When I was going to Ferguson High, when they started having more integration in Virginia, and at that time there at Ferguson High, they had a little over 2,900 whites, and they had 5 blacks in the entire school. But just 2 years earlier than that, they had that same school. They had the first 2 blacks who were attending Ferguson High there in Newport News, Virginia. And at that school, they had over 150 National Guardsmen that had to come there to make certain that those 2 students were able to go to that school in safety without any type of bodily harm or threats from other students or even people that were making threats at that time. So, I can understand what was taking place at that time, but Alan, you saw much of this throughout the South, much of the discrimination that was taking place. And of course, you had the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, you had the NAACP, you had leaders like Martin Luther King were there on the front lines, and fortunately, people like yourself, you were there on the front lines as well. Alan, I just want to go into a different direction. I just want to mention very briefly to our guests, we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program once again. He comes on every other week. And today we're discussing much of Alan's career as a community activist, as a peace activist, and also working for, working to protect workers' rights. And our program today is a fight for workers' rights. And Alan, once again, I want to thank you for joining the program today.
Well, I appreciate our discussion, Stuart.
Alan, I want to get a little bit into the area of you being a peace activist, and that's something that all of us, even today, we want peace, but we don't have it, and we definitely don't have it with this president that we have right now. I mean, they elected a president in 2008. That promised that he was going to end wars and bring our troops home and create jobs here, and it's been all but the opposite. I mean, he has escalated U.S. involvement in wars in other countries, and now we're, involved in this these incidents over there in the Ukraine where we're right on the doorsteps of Russia. Now people wondering, are we aiming for going into a broader world war? But, Alan, we can go back to the 60s, and you were there. What did you remember about the incident that happened there in the Cuban crisis, the Cuban missile crisis? And then I know you were involved, you say, back in the 60s, and that was right after that. What was your impression? I believe you. This was in 1962, so you were very young at that time. But and I'm not certain what involvement you had, but it was leading to you understanding that the U.S. should not have been involved in that war in Vietnam, and that's what we're going to talk about. What was your impression about the Cuban Missile Crisis? And then moving from that point, as you start developing your thinking that, you know, the wars, you always call them dirty wars. What
right.
made you start thinking in that direction that, you know, we needed to have peace rather than being involved in one war after another? What happened at that time in your life?
Well, I was always pretty much for peace because that's what we talked about in our home. My parents
right.
were always against these wars. My dad had been in World War II, and when he came home, he said that the United States, when he looked at it, he didn't recognize it, that he wondered if Hitler had actually won the war, because several of my relatives and stuff were brought before these House Un-American Activities Committee, and the state had similar Un-American Activities Committees. So, you know, it was pretty painful for our own family. In fact, a lot of the communist leaders that had gone underground had stayed at our home. They'd come to different people's homes to find a place to stay in order to evade prosecution or to build their cases so they could at least go into the courts. So I
right.
met a lot of these communist leaders all through the 50s when I was very young. I obviously didn't know exactly what was going on, but I knew that something was wrong by, you know, just the way my parents talked and the people that came through our house. But
around that time, what was your impression of back in the early 60s of then the Soviet Union and like many of the socialist countries and, well, supposedly socialist countries, communist countries? What was your impression of the political landscape on a global level back then?
Well, I've always believed that the socialist countries had made tremendous advances for, you know, human progress, including the
uh-huh.
Soviet Union and the Eastern European countries. A lot of people probably disagree with that, but
right.
You know, I've met a lot of people from the Soviet Union, trade union leaders, and even some political leaders.
Uh-huh.
And I've met a number of Cuban leaders, including the vice president of Cuba, who led the putting down the Bay of Pigs invasion. So, you know, I have pictures of me and my son and my granddaughter meeting with them and everything. And so I know a lot of these people, and they're good people. And, I also recognized, though, very early on in the early 70s, I would say, that there were serious problems in the Soviet Union because a lot of the so-called leaders that would come in to this country and into Canada, a lot of them were just sort of kiss asses. You know,
right.
that's my term to use. And they weren't, you know, if you tried to talk politics or Marxism with them, they didn't even want to discuss those things. So that's like they were members of the Communist Party because it was a way for them to get ahead. And
right.
I think that we see with what happened in the Soviet Union that that's just what some of these people were, just plain old kiss asses. When somebody came along with a better deal for them, like the United States, you know, that's the way they went.
And
I really
think ship.
Yeah, that's exactly what they did. They found something that was better for them. They were very selfish people, in my opinion. And, you know, I've never lost any kind of faith or anything that in socialism. I think that the socialist countries did a lot of good. They eliminated unemployment. They brought free health care for everybody. You know, there's no place else in the world where you can get a free college education and then be guaranteed a job when you graduate. You know, these are all tremendous advances. The housing problem, when you look at the Soviet Union, no matter what problems the Soviets had, their country was literally decimated two times, once during the revolution and during the intervention that was led by the United States, and then again in World War II, the country was practically leveled. They rebuilt that country two times, and a lot of people don't understand this, you know, because Americans have never experienced war on our own continent except for the Civil War, which left
right.
tremendous damage. I've been through the South, and when I was through the South in the early 2000s, I couldn't believe it. There were communities that were still suffering from the Civil War. So, you know, people don't realize what war
does. Oh, even still today. Even
yeah,
still today.
Still today. I haven't been to the South in about 10 years, But when I lived in the South, I lived in Virginia Beach for about 3 years, and I toured a lot of the South to the different Civil War battlefields and some of the towns and communities. And some of those towns and communities are still suffering from what happened during the Civil War. And, you know, the industry hasn't been rebuilt or anything else. So, you know, war wreaks real havoc for humanity, and I think the Soviet people always understood that, and they didn't want war. Right now, what we see going on in the Ukraine, these Ukrainian, I think that they're just outright fascist. In fact, you know, here in the United States, a lot of these fascists from the Ukraine and some of these Eastern European countries that had worked in cahoots with Hitler were brought into our own country. This guy named Herb Rommerstein, who now works with this billionaire Richard Mellon Scaife, he was one of the people that was responsible for giving these Nazis new identities. And then these people and many of their kids were trained to go back into these Eastern European countries and the Soviet Union and the Ukraine to create this trouble that they're having now. And, you know, this is something that the CIA did. A friend of mine was working for the unions, and he was recruited to go over to the Soviet Union to reorganize the trade unions at the time Gorbachev was in power. And he said once he got there, he realized that he was being used by the CIA. And he wanted to come back home, and they said, no, you signed on for 2 months and you're going to stay. And
right.
He was very disappointed. He said that he said when he went through the factories and stuff, he went through a large automobile factory, and he said, I never saw workers working so leisurely anyplace else. And this guy had traveled all over the world. He said, there might be four or five people sitting on a bench reading while somebody's working, and then an hour or two later, somebody else takes their turn, and they go sit on the bench, and they read books and play chess and everything else. You know, that would never happen in a U.S. factory.
Oh, no.
And, you know, so there were, I think there were major advances made in the Soviet Union, no matter what anybody says. And, you know, they obviously had problems, or they wouldn't be where they are today. But
I think, you know, when you look at that and you look at what we have here in the U.S., they try to squeeze every bit of labor out of you for whatever buck they can get. So
exactly.
Here we see today, you know, whereas a job requires three workers, they'll lay off two, and they still require the same amount of production out of that one. Or either
exactly.
They get people, they have like three people, and all of them are working 10 hours, 10 to maybe around 15 hours a week instead of giving one person full-time labor. So we can see that when you look at the way that labor is being exploited, the U.S. is probably the one example that you can look at.
Yeah.
Alan,
I worked trying to organize a sweatshop in Virginia Beach, a place called Lillian Vernon. It's a huge sweatshop, and I worked on the Meistergram machine. This is sewing like names and stuff on towels and T-shirts and stuff like that. But when it gets close to Christmas,
did you
really
say you were working there?
Yeah, I worked there for three years. Yeah.
Okay.
And the plant manager came by. He went up. There were about 300 sewing machines in the department I worked in. These Meistergram machines are huge commercial sewing machines. But the plant manager came up and down the aisle with the supervisor for the sewing department there, and they said, "Well, we're telling you, we're going on 6 days, 12 hours a day." And there was an elderly black woman, she was probably about 65, 66 years old, working at the machine in front of me. And when they told her that, she just sort of blurted out, she wasn't planning on saying it or anything, but she said to the plant supervisor, why don't you just bring back the chains? And this is the atmosphere of working in some of these southern sweatshops. I've heard other people talk about it, how they're forced to work 10 and 12 hours a day, 5, 6, and sometimes even 7 days a week. And
right.
I'll tell you, when you go home after a couple days working in these sweatshops, you don't know how you're going to get up again in the morning. You know, I was 50
right.
years old at that time, but there were many elderly people working in this sweatshop at Lillian Vernon's, people in their 60s and even into their early 70s. And it was just... I mean, there's no way I can describe how miserable the working conditions in that plant were. Just terrible. And, you know, you have anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 people working in this plant. And it's just like the movie Ants. It's, what's that? Woody Allen, his production, that comic production, like it's called The Ants.
Right.
And that's just what it seemed like. In fact, some days I brought that animation movie to work, and I started playing it, and a lot of people would say, hey, that's just like working here. You know, that's how they identified with it. And it's almost it's unbelievable, you know, the conditions that people are forced to work under in this country. And then you consider that, you know, like Lillian Vernon buys its products from Bangladesh and the Philippines and China and India. You wonder, what is it like to have to work in one of those plants overseas that makes things so cheap? You know, I saw some of the receipts from towels and stuff, and they're buying some of these things so cheap for like 15 cents and 10 cents from these countries, and then they come here and they sell it and they personalize it, and they charge, you know, $15-$25 for this.
Crap,
really, you know. And but you wonder how people are working in these other countries.
Alan, I want to talk a little bit about your career as being a peace activist, and I just want to make a brief announcement to our listeners. Once again, we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program once again. Alan comes on every other week sharing a lot of good information that pertains to the left. Today we're actually going in a different direction and just – oh, I shouldn't say a different direction, because we're talking about Alan's career as an activist, a peace activist, working to protect human rights. And the name of our program and our discussion for today is A Fight for Workers' Rights. And Alan, thanks again. Alan, we're going to be talking a little bit about you being a peace activist, because we can see at a very early age you're already being arrested. You know, you're already on the radar of the U.S. government. You're definitely on the radar for a lot of states. But around that same time, we could see in 1965, the U.S. was getting heavily involved in this war. By the time of 1967 and 68, we can see that the Vietnam War, every day you open up the newspapers, you saw the photos of young men that had been killed. You turn on the television and you saw planes that were landing and they had to drape coffins. And Alan, this was on a daily basis.
Right.
As a result of that war, and we'll talk a little bit about the war, but as a result of that, over 58,000 U.S. service individuals were actually killed as a result of that. Much of what I saw during that time, and you can see the same thing as well, Alan, many of our young men, especially if they were minorities and blacks, I mean, you get out of high school, not even weeks after you are out of high school, you're already being drafted. Within 6 months, you're on your way over to Vietnam. I had some friends, personal friends that I had gone to high school with. They were shipped out before they even turned 19 years, well, one before he was 19. The other one, he wasn't even 20 years old. Both of them were killed over in Vietnam shortly after they had gotten there. But, Alan, we could see that was a turning point for millions of Americans saying that they were tired of war, but they were already saying that they did not want war back in the mid-60s when they were already talking about that. But tell me what your messaging, the messaging that you were putting out there and the groups that you were working with back in the early 60s in opposition to the Vietnam War.
Well, I was working with a group of people largely around integration, and these same people began to become active against the war in Vietnam. It was at one of our meetings on integration where we decided to have a demonstration in front of the federal building, and we put out leaflets and everything, and we thought, oh, lots of people are going to come, and about 15 people showed up, mostly elderly people. In fact, one of the people that was a leader of this was Walter Bergman, who was a major leader of the Socialist Party. Him and Bill Glenn, who was a leader of the Communist Party, they worked together all the time. anyways, they called together this group of people since they had already been working on integration and said, you know, these wars are just taking everything out of us. There had been the Korean War and then the Vietnam War. And they said, well, you know, let's have a protest. And at the same time, people around the country were holding these little vigils and stuff. So we had our little vigil in front of the federal building in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And, you know, we were sort of disappointed with the turnout, but we carried our signs and we chanted and everything. The next time we had a demonstration, about 2 months later, about 300 or 400 people showed up. And, I mean, the sentiment, once people started to consider these wars, it just started multiplying, you know, very rapidly, the number of people that began to speak out against these wars. And this continued, you know,
Well, what did you understand at the time of Americans' involvement in the war? Because it became very unclear to millions of Americans, like, why are we even here? Why are we there? I mean,
exactly.
You would see them go, and they would go and take a certain area of the countryside. And after they go and lose so many lives and they would capture those lives, I mean, capture those areas, then they would be 6-7 months later, they'd be fighting for the same areas. But, Alan, what was the thinking when, you know, that we were involved in a war and you could not see no end in sight? And worst of all, you were trying to figure out, why are we even here? Was there any clear understanding with most of the people, what you could see then, why we were even there in Vietnam?
Well, from talking to people back during those times, most of the people
I found
were opposed to, most of the people were opposed to the war right from the beginning.
Right.
You know, they thought they didn't have a lot of faith in the politicians. We had just come out of the Korean War, you know, 12 years before, and people were, there was a lot of opposition to the Korean War, even though it wasn't an open opposition because there was such a campaign on the part of Joe McCarthy to silence people. So this opposition to the Vietnam War began to build into a massive movement, and people just said, you know, we're not going to take this red baiting and we're not going to fight your wars. One of my best friends, a kid named Roger Jameson, was one of, I think he was the first casualty, the first person to die from our high school. And it really hit kids hard. And there was very little support. When I was drafted, I didn't exactly refuse to go. I told them, give me a gun and you better worry about which way I'll shoot. So after a couple of years, they finally decided they weren't going to take me after they tried to induct me like that. But a lot of the people that I went to induction with, there were, like, you know, several thousand young people called for induction, young guys. And a lot of the people were from my high school class. And one kid got his knees blown apart. And, you know, he came in one day about 5 years after he got back, and he says, geez, I don't know why more of us didn't stand up like you did at the time of induction. But when I was inducted, there were about 200 people, 200 kids that refused to go out of a couple thousand. And so, you know, that's quite a few. And, you know, that opposition just multiplied. In Grand Rapids, we had a demonstration, over 5,000 people. Grand Rapids is a town of 200,000 people. 5,000 people marched a mile through the streets of Grand Rapids protesting the war in Vietnam, and that was going on all over the country. I mean, there was just massive opposition. People were fed up with wars. They didn't want any part of the Vietnam War. They felt the politicians were shoving that war down their throats. People didn't really have to be won to the opposition. People had to be convinced to come out into the streets to oppose it. And that was the hard part. The easy part was, you know, convincing people that the war was wrong, and it was easy because most people already agreed that the war was wrong. But getting people to come out to the streets, they didn't want to be called communists. Joe McCarthy's antics were still fresh in people's minds, and people were afraid of losing their jobs. So this had to be overcome. And the way that was overcome,
Alan,
is when more people got involved.
How did communication, how did television play a role in people understanding about these dirty wars back in the 60s? Because, Alan, every time you turn on the television, I mean, they would show graphic scenes, like, you see that hole over there, there's a Viet Cong over there in that hole, and this is what we're going to do, and and they had reporters out there in the field. I mean, the war was fought right there on television. But how did this affect the American psyche at the time and embolden the message that you had when people were seeing this every day?
Well,
because
I think what
it was sickening.
Yeah, the message that it sent, I think, was that people did not want their kids to go and fight this war. I know at one demonstration, a grandfather who lost his grandson in the Vietnam War came to speak, and he spoke in very vulgar terms and everything. I mean, he was just totally mad and angry that, you know, he lost his grandson. And I think when people saw this killing going on their television sets, they didn't want their kids to go. I know when I was called up 3 or 4 times for induction, and every time I went down there to get on the bus, there were all these mothers that were standing there just crying and crying. You know, they did not want their sons going off to war because they knew, they saw on television all these soldiers being killed and wounded. You know, 58,000 U.S. Servicemen were killed in Vietnam, but, you know, a couple hundred thousand at least were wounded, not to mention how many Vietnamese were killed. And, human beings, they don't like to see this kinds of violence. They don't like to see their own sons and daughters killed, but they don't like to see other people killed either. This is just human nature. Most people do not like, wars. So it's very...
Alan, you were fighting for veterans back then. I mean, veterans when they were coming back. You have well over 4 decades of fighting for, you know, protecting, you know, the rights of veterans. But how were they what did you see? How were they treating the veterans even back then? Because we can see the way they treat them now. Ones coming back from the war that need, you know, psychiatric help. Ones that, that have been wounded in the war. Ones that cannot come back. Ones that come back and they cannot find job, employment. But what did you see back then that made you decide that you wanted to even be more of a stronger advocate for veterans even back in the 60s and 70s? How were they treating the veterans then?
Well, almost everybody that I knew my age that was coming back from Vietnam, or maybe 2 or 3 years older, they were either came back wounded and they couldn't receive the proper medical attention, or they came back with their minds seriously, you know, they were incapable of even functioning in society.
Just like they're doing
today, right?
They weren't
getting any kind of psychiatric help. What?
Just like today.
Yeah, I don't know if it's worse today, but it's just as bad today. And, for a human being to go through those kinds of experiences, it's not normal. And so it creates all these problems in people's heads, and they need, real psychiatric help when they get back. There's a certain segment of society where they can go kill a human being just like they can shoot a rabbit or a deer, and it makes no difference to them. You know, but this is a very small minority of those that are going over there to fight. Even though now we got people that join voluntarily, they do not expect to see the things that they're seeing over in Afghanistan or Iraq or, you know, in the Philippines. And they see this carnage being carried out before their very eyes, and it changes their whole way of thinking, you know. They do not want to be over there anymore. A friend of mine is living in Canada right now who went AWOL, and he said, there's no way that I'm going to go back. He says, I didn't realize what it was like when I signed up. You know, he says, I was young and it didn't really mean anything to me. A human life didn't mean a lot to me. And then you see this killing before your very eyes. And he says, there was no way that he was going to go back. So he went AWOL and he's living in Canada now. There are, you know, several hundred Americans living in Canada that refuse to fight these wars. And, it's a little different now because before there was a draft, so Canadians welcomed the Americans because they were being forced to fight the wars. Now there isn't quite so much support because they figure that these are Americans that voluntarily joined, although that attitude is changing in Canada quite a bit. But several of these Americans have already been deported to face jail time. A young woman, I forgot her first name, her last name is Rivera, she was deported from Canada and ended up doing 10 months in a military prison. There was a big fight to try and prevent her deportation. She had little kids and a husband, and they were living very contently in Canada, and the Canadian government deported them. Very mean
Alan,
and nasty.
Can you share with our listeners how many of these dirty wars that we have out here, how it's all about the profits for the military industrial complex? Because we're talking about trillions of dollars. But
right.
how does it benefit the military industrial complex?
Well, all of these wars are being fought for natural resources or cheap labor, usually both. And, you know, in Vietnam, it was huge rubber plantations, and they knew that Shell Oil has always known that there was oil on the coast of Vietnam. So, you know, that's the Vietnam War was to protect Wall Street's profits and their assets. And, you know, the same thing with Iraq. You have the oil fields in Afghanistan. You have huge pipelines that pipe gas and everything into Europe going through there. And then, you know, the CIA has known for years that there's been all kinds of valuable minerals in the mountains in Afghanistan. So, you know, these are the things that have always been fought for. General Smedley Butler, who was a big general, you know, he came away from these wars saying that, you know, I've been like a racketeer protecting Wall Street's interest all over the world. And a lot of people don't realize this, but many leading American generals, there was Smedley Butler, there were a number of other generals that came out against the Vietnam War because they realized that, you know, the Korean War was just another war to go after natural resources in Korea. And they opposed these wars. You know, general after general has opposed these wars because they know that the wars are wrong, and yet, you know, we got these generals fighting the wars today because they're being told to fight them. Their life is the military, and they'll do whatever the so-called commander-in-chief tells them to do. But
and like you say, Alan, it's all about the natural resources, cheap labor, and expanding the empire, because what is being done is they're just expanding the colonies, just like the British did, the French did, and it's the same thing. It's the U.S. Army. When they say protecting American interests is protecting Wall Street interests. It has nothing to do with working people in this country. Alan, we have like around 10 more minutes in this. We could discuss, you know, your career for the next couple of days, let alone the next 10 minutes. But I'm gonna let you just share a little bit. You have been a very strong labor organizer and working with, you know, organizing unions, working with the Indian gaming casinos. I want you to share a little bit about what you've been doing in that area, because what you're doing there is so powerful. Share with us about your career as a labor organizer.
Well, I've been involved in union organizing that in one form or another since I was about 18 years old, since I got fired from the first job. I was working as a carpenter, and the building trades unions were trying to organize the place where I was working, a place called Saab Construction. And that's when I first got involved in unions. I've done a lot of research and writing leaflets and done a lot of things that you might say unions don't do on their own because they don't want to be involved in some of the things that have to be done in order to win strikes and stuff. So I've done some of those things. And right now, I started.
And what's going on with the gaming industry that you're working with? Because you're constantly working to, you know, to protect their rights. Many of these smoke-filled casinos, how it's killing these people that are working in these casinos.
Right.
And this is happening not just where you're at. It's half across the nation. I mean, these people are not being protected at all.
Exactly. Across the United States, people don't realize how large this industry is. There's over 350 of these they're the so-called Indian casinos. But what people don't understand is that it's a bunch of rich white mobsters that own every aspect of this Indian gaming industry. They own the slot machines. They own the table games. They reap
the
profits from the hotels all across the country. And it's people like the Fertitta family. If you watch the movie Casino, this is literally about these mobsters that have been involved in the casino industry and that have branched off to the Indian gaming industry. These very violent mobsters like the Fertitta family have become involved in managing these Indian casinos. And in some of these casinos, they take 85% of the profits right off the top.
85%?
85%. The Fertitta family signed a contract to manage the Gun Lake Casino, one of the casinos in Michigan where we're trying to organize. And part of the contract calls for them to receive 85% of the profits. And, you know, so these mobsters are making out literally like bandits. And this is why, you know, Native American communities are still so impoverished. In fact, all that the Native American communities are left with is a huge pile of debt. The teacher union pension funds are the main financiers of these casinos, building the casinos and bringing in the slot machines and everything. And it's mobsters, the most mobbed up union today in the United States is not the Teamsters, which a lot of people think, but is the teachers union. And,
oh, really?
I didn't
know that.
The teacher union pension funds are invested with an outfit called Fortress Investment for a large part. And this is the outfit that got the guy that got out, that was running for president, that got into trouble from the South there. What was his name from North Carolina?
Edwards.
Yeah, Edwards.
Edwards.
He was a part of this Fortress Investment, and that's what got him messed up, is because the mobsters told him to lay off on the workers' rights thing, and he refused to do that, so they caused him all kinds of trouble. And, you know, it's a very dirty business. There's prostitution, there's drug pushing, there's the loan sharking, there's selling stolen merchandise. All of this goes on. These are all businesses that go on within these casinos, and the casino workers are dragged into it because they're told, if you don't work with us and sell our drugs and take our bets, like they have illegal betting on all the football games, baseball games, basketball games, high school, college football games, they have all this illegal betting going on in these casinos. And, you know, like when I worked as a dealer in the casino up here, they tried to make me take the bets, and I refused to do that. And they didn't know what to do because I told them, you know, you can fire me for not taking your bets, but I'm going to go to the police and tell them exactly what you're doing here.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, that's what we did, because they were dragging. It's hard to organize in the Indian gaming industry because all these people, these workers, have been dragged into all these illicit and illegal doings, whether it's taking the illegal bets or, you know, the dope pushers, like here at the Red Lake Gaming Enterprises. The head dope pusher is actually the chairman of the Red Lake Band, a guy named Floyd Jourdain. We showed pictures of his brother actually exchanging money and dope inside the casinos, taken with their own cameras by people on our organizing committee that worked in the security. And it took them 7 years before they arrested this guy.
Wow.
And, you know, he was getting casino workers to hand out bags of his dope and stuff and taking the money, and he would go walking away with clean hands. You know, these are the kinds of things that go on. They take young women and turn them into prostitutes. They say, oh, you know, here's a couple hundred dollars. Go out and have some fun and party with these high rollers. You know, and, you know, $200 looks pretty good to somebody that comes from a dirt poor life, you know.
Exactly.
And this is the way this industry operates. And it's
Alan,
mobsters, outright mobsters that control this industry. And
yeah,
all these workers work without any rights. They have no rights under state or federal labor laws because the Democratic Party created these compacts that created the situation the way that it is.
Alan, I have around two more minutes, and I just want to, I believe Ruth Ann is still on the line with us. She's going to be having you to come on as a guest on one of her other programs. But I just want you to share a little bit. We have around a minute and a half to share what you're doing as far as political organizing between various political parties and candidates with the new Progressive Alliance. That's the way that I really became, the way that I came in contact with you, where you were asking me to get involved with that organization. But could you take around a minute or so to share with us what you're doing for political organizing?
Sure. We, the New Progressive Alliance and a group called Uniting People have joined together, and we're holding forums around Minnesota. Our first forum was held in Duluth. 140 people showed up. The next forum was held in Minneapolis, and about between 50 and 60 people showed up at that forum. But what we're doing is we're bringing people on the left together to try to get people to see that, you know, in spite of our ideological differences, when it comes to real issues that affect working people like the minimum wage, we got to start working together in spite of our ideological differences. And we're having some pretty good success. You know, we've put a lot of pressure on the Democrats to raise the minimum wage to a real living wage. They campaign for office saying that they were for a living non-poverty wage. Once they got elected, they come and bring forward another poverty wage of anywhere from $7.75 to $8 to $9.50 an hour. And, you know, we're exposing all this. We've brought these people together, and now we're writing letters to the editor. We've joined together to write letters to the editor about what's going on with the minimum wage issue. So, you know, we got to bring people together face-to-face, not just working on the Internet, but we got to use the Internet as a tool to begin to bring people together, and that's what we're doing around Minnesota. We expect to hold about probably 15 of these forums across the state within the next year and a half leading up to the 2016 elections. And, you know, we already have close to 200 people involved, so this is going to be a powerful influence.
Well, Alan, I have to really say that you are a true heavyweight when it comes to representing the working class, and I want to tell you I appreciate your service to working people across the country and also worldwide. Ruth Ann, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am. Alan's going to be on Feed Your Head this Friday night, 7 o'clock Central. And we're going to be talking a lot more about the work he's been doing on the reservations.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that. And thanks again, Ruth Ann, for everything that you do to help to keep this program alive and where our listeners can join us on a weekly basis. And Alan, again, I want to thank you for joining our program. We'll be looking forward to having you. Looking forward to having you on Ruth Ann's program this week. And once again, I want to thank you, Ruth Ann, and our listeners for joining the Socialist Insight. See you next week. Have a good night, everyone.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for having me, Stuart.
On blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
How's it going? This is Dialectics. Welcome. I'm your host, Nikolai Brown. We got a lot of good stuff coming up this week. This week's guest is Jacob Brown. Jacob Jacobin Brown, as he's also known. He's also one of the guests, or one of the hosts of All Power to the Positive Radio, and a member of Anti-Imperialist Action in Seattle, and also a RAIM supporter. So before we get into that, Just a couple quick notes about what's going on in terms of media stuff on antiimperialism.com. There's a really great article on the social construction of sex. It's part one from Morton Esters. Let's see. There is an original article about the Russian basically invading and occupying Crimea and whatever the U.S. is trying to do there. And there's a pretty interesting article about Australia's genocidal campaign against the people of the Pacific and Middle East. So check that out. That's on antiimperialism.com. Also recently, Dare to Win magazine came out. It's a new kind of news and analysis magazine, kind of meant for a broader audience, people who might not necessarily have a background in Marxism and such. So definitely check that out. And that's up on revolutionaryaim.org. So now we have Jacob Jackman Brown. Are you on there?
I sure hope I am. Can you hear me?
How's it? Yes, I can. How's
okay,
it going?
Perfect. We're on. Oh, it's going pretty good. there's a lot of groundwork that still needs to be done before this next May Day. That's kind of in the proverbial first world. That's kind of how we're able to connect with any type of viable social base for revolution within the belly of the beast is in and around May Day, working with migrants. So that's kind of what's on the table right now. And regionally, we're just taking it step by step, the Maoist approach to things, not being dogmatic about it. But it is a pretty big task. I mean, because you're talking about something that's pretty big, and you got to be able to sink deep roots in the social base you're working with. But it's great to be on, though. I mean, it's a hell of a thing to follow up Ward Churchill and Amalia Shatila. So.
Definitely. Well, thanks for joining me. But before we get into some of the stuff on the organizing you're doing, you've been around for a while. You have pretty steady politics. We've been working together for a little while. So I thought, we kind of do like a little segment maybe called like Around the World with Nick and Jacob, where we discuss some of the stuff that's happening recently, because it's been pretty chaotic in the world. And, no better way to do that than just look at the homepage of democracynow.org and, kind of analyze their headlines. So first up we have Russia seizes parts of Ukraine's Crimea amid standoff with U.S. So what's going on here? I know this is kind of provoking a lot of discussion amongst leftist forces, and it's creating a lot of, I don't want to say tension, but it's really bringing out different sort of lines and worldviews as it relates to everything, but it's kind of being the focal point is this conflict. So what's your take on it?
Well, fascist forces backed by the United States and the EU have seized power. I predicted that as soon as that happened, Russia was going to act after the Sochi Games, that Russia, it doesn't matter which of the bourgeois parties were in charge, in Russia currently, Russia generally was not going to tolerate a fascist coup d'état in one of the former Soviet countries. I mean, no way. I mean, so I predicted that this was going to happen, that Russia was going to invade, and they would have quite a bit of popular support, especially in the East, for doing so. I guess I didn't realize how strongly and quickly they would move. I would, expect a little bit of diplomacy at first, but wow. I mean, I definitely got that one right. so that's concurrently what you see happening. I don't think World War III is going to happen from this. I think NATO is really kind of, going to chicken out on this, because I don't think they have the resources to be able to take Russia head on, even though that's what they're designed to do. I don't think that's a road they want to go down. So,
inter-imperialism. Even though they kind of say they're there to fight Russia and in case they ever attack, NATO has most definitely been a kind of tool of imperialism against, mostly third world and semi-peripheral peoples.
Yeah, it's been it's been the face of imperialism. Against the people of the world for pretty much its entire existence, following World War II. That's and you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, NATO extending its mandate, so to speak, to, you know, attack an independent African country like Libya, for instance, you know, and its proposed involvement in Syria as well. Yeah, there's no question that what NATO's role truly is in the world. You know, it's not just managing a geopolitical inter-imperialist conflict between the Russian Empire and the G7 countries, but really keeping the masses of the world down and in their place. So, I mean, that's why folks see me using through social media and whatnot the classic anti-NATO symbol from back during the aggression against Libya and that was also briefly popularized during the anti-NATO protests going on in this country.
Well, and it's interesting. Yeah, you mentioned you're using the symbol that kind of arose during the protests against U.S. intervention, or U.S. really, and EU and NATO aggression against Libya. And mm-hmm. this is really part of a pattern, it seems like, is the sort of U.S.-sponsored color revolutions. In this case, it was a little bit too close to Russia for Russia to allow it,
you know,
and it got a little bit too much out of hand. Russia has been a little bit more diplomatic whenever it comes to places like Syria and Libya. I mean, they kind of backed away from Libya, and it seemed like that bit them in the ass in terms of, you know, they had
a pretty
stable relationship with the Libyan kind of comprador bourgeoisie, false nationalist comprador bourgeoisie that was Gaddafi. Or that was, you know, the regime centered around Gaddafi, I guess I should say.
The bourgeois pan-nationalist regime there, yeah.
Yeah, and I wanted to kind of jump back really quick, because it's interesting how this, you know, this isn't like a, a random occurrence. I mean, if you read, what was that document back in the day, like Project for a New American Century? I mean, neoconservatives were talking about this in the 90s in terms of kind of surrounding Russia and making sure that Russia and China didn't, ascend essentially at the expense of U.S.-led imperialism. So that seems to be what's playing out today. And you said something else. You said the Russian Empire, and I found that kind of interesting. I very much agree. But it seems like there's a lot of kind of, I don't think they're Marxists, because I don't think, you know, you can call it, use this analysis and still be a Marxist, but there's a lot of kind of leftists out there that tend to say that Russia is this somehow non-imperialist force. That somehow, I don't know, doing this, invading Crimea out of the benevolence of their own, you know, hearts or something of that extent. What's your take on what's going on in Russia? What's the dynamic that's leading them to respond in such a way?
Well, it's their particular old school version of imperialism for Russia, that is. I mean, it goes back throughout the history of the Russian Empire and for Maoists, for Maoist political economy, Maoists understand the Soviet Union post-World War II to be effectively, operationally, an imperialist state in the Leninist sense, that, you know, it was taking more from the global social product of the world than it was giving out. Even then, it wasn't really fully imperialist in that sense. Nowhere near as parasitic as the West, but nevertheless, you know, the relationship that the Soviet Union had with other countries that were attempting to break away from colonialism, was one of a, you know, kind of a patronizing relationship, or not kind of, really was a patronizing relationship, as well as, you know, the Soviet Union really at that time not really pushing things forward as far as breaking with the law of value and whatnot, really big on the theory of the productive forces, and really what in my mind, you know, put the Soviet Union into the camp of being imperialist was this line advanced by Khrushchev and then later Brezhnev afterwards, even though Brezhnev had Khrushchev and his cronies deposed, but this operation was, you know, still lasted all the way through Yuri Andropov's leadership and Mikhail Gorbachev's, was the notion of the internationalist division of labor between different socialist countries. So essentially a more benevolent version of what Western imperialism has already been doing, to its colonies, which is, you know, warping economies to create giant monocultural, based economies. If the primary products and, you know, an agricultural product, or, you know, gearing the economy around, you know, two or three basic commodities that way, you know, or just taking whatever resources they do have and, you know, stripping the country blind, basically. You know, so it was
so
a more benevolent version of that. What's that?
And you're saying this is a continuation of that sort of relationship?
Yeah, a continuation of that relationship, social imperialism, socialism in words, imperialism in deeds. So, I mean, it happened in Cuba, for instance, you know. Soviets basically got Cuba to produce a bunch of sugar for them. But granted, the Cubans got a better deal for becoming a monocultural plantation, sugar plantation for the Soviets, than they would for the West. Nevertheless, you know, for Maoists, we can't really call that, an independent socialist development. You know, that's not really the socialist transition that we think is healthy, and that really puts the masses in charge of history in those situations. You know, it doesn't really get us closer to communism and away from commodity production. So that's kind of our view on it.
To jump in, I think in some respects it seems like, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union was something of a break in Russia, which really did throw away the kind of political vestiges of, you know, what was left of socialism, you know, by 1990 or whatnot. You know, there hadn't really been kind of stable socialism, you know, for 40-some years or 40 years in Russia. I have a slightly different analysis, and I guess I'll just throw it out there, and it goes something like this.
Yeah.
And then you have countries like Russia and China and Brazil in which they have a large territory, a huge territory, in fact, and, you know, uh-huh. Russia is larger than the United States, that are very wealthy in terms of natural resources and productive mm-hmm. populations. And insofar as it is one political territory, over time and given kind of political initiatives, they can accumulate enough capital to kind of develop a competing monopoly capital, so to speak, competing to already established U.S.-led imperialism. So it mm-hmm. seems to be a kind of inter-imperialist rivalry playing out between what I would call like more of a decadent kind of old U.S.-led Western imperialism or trilateral imperialism, if you include Japan, and more ascendant sort of Russian and Chinese-led imperialism. And what I think is kind of interesting is that in some respects, what you have in kind of China and Russia today is something like the political future of capitalism, where it's, you know, all the benefits of capitalism in terms of being able to exploit people, but none of the political fetters of democracy, none of the you know, things that are becoming
bourgeois democracy.
Yes, essentially, as capitalism wears on, too, it needs to exploit more. So, you know, these kind of democratic features become more of a fetter on society. So it's interesting to watch this all play out. And, of course, it's probably going to heat up more. You're probably right. It's probably not going to, you know, evolve into World War III overnight. But it is interesting to see that rising tension and inter-imperialist rivalry between U.S. and Russian-led imperialism. And I have a little bit of sympathy for the people who, you know, deny that Russia is imperialist in terms of, I think we should primarily oppose the United States and its, you know, the fascist forces it backs in Ukraine. But nonetheless, I don't think we should kind of deny reality because of that. That's just my opinion.
Well, there's two things involved there. You know, for communists, you know, for their anti-imperialism to be really rooted in something, far going with a maximum program towards communism, you got to have your anti-capitalism going along with your anti-imperialism. If you don't have that, I mean, it's something JMP said on what was it called, MLMMayhem.blogspot.com, that I thought was interesting that way. If you're anti-capitalist without being anti-imperialist, you're not anti-capitalist, and the reverse of that. You know, if you're not anti-capitalist with being anti-imperialist, you're not really anti-imperialist in the long run either. So that's kind of how I approach the whole question. Now, granted, you know, we're in here in the belly of the beast, the Western, you know, the Western Empire, the proverbial first world or global north. You know, and that gives us both a responsibility as you know, part of the populations that benefit from that plunder, you know, and not just a responsibility, but also an opportunity to help bring this empire down behind enemy lines, as those of us who advanced, you know, global people's war like to talk about. You know, so there's no I mean... I don't think anybody in RAME, correct me if I'm wrong, likes to put themselves up as the vanguard of global peoples war. No. No, we wouldn't be that arrogant. What I do think is that folks who have been in the struggle, you know, people who have been in the struggle in the global south, even doing straight-up people's war against the empire and its lackeys locally, their constant request to us and to any revolutionaries in the global north has always been, you know, make revolution where you're at. Now, that's kind of a tough thing to do given, you know, the objective conditions we have. You know, we lack, you know, kind of a natural immiserated social base, you know, that's ready to rise up in revolution, you know, because of the objective conditions. But we kind of have to do it anyway. I mean, because there's really no more effective third world action out there. You know, and that requires, you know, building base areas and dual power, yeah. You know, so
and even if you're not going to be able to build revolution overnight, being able to build that sort of oppositional social movement that draws attention away, you know, draws the imperialist attention away from the third world and places it kind of, you know, now they have to put out this fire in their own country kind of thing, in their own house, rather than kind of shooting on their neighbor's house. You know, that can play a very functional and very progressive service in revolution in the terms of the world scale, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we definitely should be striving for a maximum program of revolution.
Yeah.
But even creating that kind of oppositional movement,
mm-hmm.
that is, you know, for lack of a better word, kind of fucking shit up and creating a little bit of chaos. And I don't want to sound like, you know, an anarchist or a nihilist or something like that, but more or less drawing the attention away and the full weight of the repressive machine off of third world people so that they can establish their own kind of independent political power in the third world, which can only weaken imperialism and make it easier to overthrow it behind enemy lines.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of the classic dialectical, you know, to bring it back to the title of the program, the dialectical back and forth between resistance in the first world and revolution in the third world. You know, we're partisans behind enemy lines in that sense, and our job is, as you said, to be fucking shit up. you know, to put it bluntly. So, yeah, I mean that's both our responsibility and our opportunity right out in front of us to be able to, you know, play that role however we can. You know, granted, you know, lacking a cohesive majority social base that's, you know, ready for revolution in one way or another, given the objective conditions of imperialism. I mean, yeah, it's going to be patchwork stuff, you know, appeal to moral ideals and that kind of thing. You know, however, you know, anti-imperialist politics do kind of take priority, you know, for us here in the belly of the beast. You know, it keeps us internationalist, you know, it keeps us focused on the maximum program, and it keeps us away from first worldism, you know, getting involved in politics that wrap people up in keeping more than their fair share of the global social product, even if it's so-called working class struggles, you know.
Let me jump in, and maybe you can kind of relate that to this, because there's another, again, I'm looking at just the front page of Democracy Now!, and there's another headline, nearly 400 people arrested protesting Keystone XL pipeline at White House. And here's an example where people are kind of moving to some extent, you know, and granted, like, getting arrested and like a sit-in or whatnot isn't exactly the height of militancy, but or even really challenging the state and, you know, capitalism or whatnot. But here's an example of people kind of acting in a way to advance their own perceived interests. They don't want to, you know, drink polluted water, and they don't want to live in a country with oil pipelines running through them. But nonetheless, you know, they are kind of moving. They're not just kind of sitting in front of the TV and, you know, chanting Go America and things like this. So how would you propose, I mean, you mentioned kind of staying on top of the internationalism issue. I mean, this is definitely, it seems like an issue that anti-imperialists and revolutionaries and Maoists and whatnot need to get involved in. Definitely not, you know, just tailing the movement, I suppose, but interjecting a more revolutionary internationalist line and revolutionary anti-imperialist line. And so I'm kind of wondering, what would that look like?
Oh, what would that look like? Well, I look at a lot of these kind of struggles that you point out as the types of, you know, struggles related to issues that do almost on a spontaneous level require people who get involved in that. It requires them to already be thinking in a mode outside of their immediate material interests. So it goes beyond like the $15 an hour thing, which is, you know, for reasons I could get into for the rest of the program, is, as far as I'm concerned, is social chauvinist and social imperialist maneuver, you know, if it's not extended to all the working class of the world, you know what I mean? But beyond that, so things like the Keystone Pipeline, things like the movement against Monsanto, these are things that, you know, even though they might be limited in scope as far as getting the big picture of the, you know, this capitalist imperialist system, you know, it still forces people that are getting involved in this stuff to look, you know, beyond their immediate material interests and looking at things in a systematic way. Also, with the Keystone Pipeline movement, we're also talking about the so-called fourth world contradiction with the first world. That is the struggles of indigenous people against settler colonialism, specifically, you know, on an internal basis, you know, to the occupation of Turtle Island. So there's that aspect of it as well.
I'm glad you brought that up. Just to kind of explain, here we have a situation in which, you know, people are being dislocated. Their traditional land is being, you know, scarred, degraded, for profits that aren't going to benefit their people. They're going to benefit, you know, primarily the imperialist bourgeoisie of the white nation, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So in this sense, it's a kind of colonialism against First Nation peoples, and that's why they've acted so resolutely against the Keystone XL pipeline, because they see it as this. They, you know, even if, you know, maybe they understand it better than me, I don't know. But intuitively, or whatnot, however, they've definitely risen in a mass response to this, and that's something that should be supported. And, you know, I guess I think it does kind of force people to look somewhat outside the box, but I think without that sort of revolutionary element, this is important, without that sort of revolutionary element, things get co-opted by, you know, MoveOn.org or any number of kind of social democratic nonprofits that are out there. What is it, the 360.org, any, you know, I mean, so there needs to be that sort of revolutionary element that's acting within it and trying to connect with the masses and move them towards a more radical position, as, you know, and as they're going to find out that these little sit-ins and things are not going to work over the long term. It's, you know, even if you do stop this one pipeline, it's only going to be a delay. It's going to be, you know, a small hiccup to the overall functioning of the system.
Yeah.
So revolutionaries need to be there to egg on that adoption of militancy, that adoption of a deeper understanding of, you know, the role of the state, you know, the function of, you know, classes and how they relate to one another, things of that nature.
Yeah. I mean, even with the movement for Monsanto, you know, even though on a spontaneous level it might raise people's sights a little bit more, Monsanto is just one capitalist institution amongst many who, you know, make up this imperialist system that we're talking about, not just one evil company, you know. And that's the other thing is getting people to think scientifically about these things, and not just, you know, and mentally break their to use Farrakhan's terms here, break their covenant with death, so to speak, you know, as far as their covenant with this thing called bourgeois democracy and the bourgeois ideals that, you know, capitalism is okay so long as companies behave ethically. Well, systematically, that's not possible. I mean, capitalism's number one thing is to put profitability ahead of people. I mean, that's, and so we got to constantly reiterate that. This is capitalism in generally, you know, does this stuff to people all around the world on a systemic level. So.
Well, that's interesting you bring up ethics. I saw this story the other day, and this isn't from Democracy Now!, but Idaho just passed an ag gag law, essentially making it illegal to videotape acts of animal cruelty in factory farms. And it would make animal cruelty is illegal in most states, with usually very light punishments. And so this ag gag law actually makes somebody who videotapes an act of animal cruelty happening in a factory farm facility against, you know, a pig or an actual animal, a cow, something like that, is the actual penalty for filming that is greater than carrying out the act of cruelty. And it really shows kind of, so here's a system in which, you know, necessarily is going to produce animal cruelty. Like, you're not going to have a factory uh-huh. farm without animal cruelty. Even if you, you know, somehow, I mean, the whole setup is cruel. I mean, you're putting these animals in cages, but then you have these low-wage workers, you know, a lot of them, you know, are nationally oppressed, and, you know, they're working in this, you know, what has to be a disgusting workplace, long hours, low pay. So they take out a lot of their oppression on these animals often. And then you get case, and then you have organizations that go in and, you know, try to catch this animal cruelty. And a lot of times it doesn't even hurt the owners of the facility. They get a little bit of bad press, you know, maybe, you know, a popular restaurant pulls its, you know, changes its supplier from Tyson to something else. But usually it doesn't really, you know, the law, the state, so to speak, isn't cracking down on the owners of the factory farms. They're just, you know, pressing animal cruelty charges against, you know, the workers and, you know.
Oh, hell no, yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, that's kind of a screwy situation anyways. And now you have these states, this is the seventh, Idaho, passing these laws where it's illegal to even go in and figure out what's going on in these places, if there's something illegal going on, if there's this animal cruelty going on or not. Especially animal cruelty, I guess I would say, you know, where you do have kind of people hitting, kicking, stabbing, you know, molesting, you know, all these things to cows and pigs and other animals and chickens and things like this that people often eat in the United States. So it's an interesting case of the state moving in to protect the big agricultural interests.
Yeah.
You know, against, you know, what is pretty sensible. I mean, in terms of ethics.
Yeah.
You know, it's not cool to stab a cow with a pitchfork. I mean, it's pretty sensible. I mean, it's one thing to eat animals. It's another thing to basically torture them throughout their lives, I suppose.
Yeah. What it reminds me of is the late, relating to cannabis prohibition, a book by the late, I'm blanking on his name now. The Emperor Wears No Clothes was the name of the book. Jack Herrera, that was his name. Also a famous cannabis strain named right after him, because this book was so influential in the sense that not everything in the book was accurate, but Jack Herrera did make a good case in the book that cannabis prohibition was not just about a racist response to Mexican migrants, but also specifically pushed by pharmaceutical and certain textile chemical companies, so specifically like DuPont, DuPont and Dow Chemical were some of the two biggest ones, and other big time pharmaceutical companies. They've changed names since, I think, but examples are like that, including when you're also talking about petroleum energy companies and even something as, you know, which is now on the decline, tobacco companies, big tobacco, as they say. I mean, we're talking about companies with, a lot of capital to spend, and they use that capital in the bourgeois democracy they're a part of to get legislation passed. I mean, even if it contradicts their own so-called First Amendment, you know, as far as free speech goes, you know.
If we're talking about marijuana legalization, all these issues, I think it's important to mention in terms of another big sponsor of drug prohibition is prison guard unions.
A
huge sponsor of trying to stop states like Colorado and Washington from, you know, basically legalizing to a degree marijuana. And you mentioned kind of, you know, some of the reasons behind prohibition. It wasn't just against Mexicans, but I feel like I should point out that the reason why it's called marijuana is while they were doing prohibition, they figured marijuana would sound more exotic, more third world, more foreign.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then that would make it easier to ban the public campaign that went along with making it illegal. I mean, I'm sure most people have seen Reefer Madness and stuff like that. But that's why that's why the term marijuana came into the public vernacular in the United States, was part of that campaign to demonize, this drug by associating it with Mexicans, essentially.
And
I have no doubt that, you know, there's all sorts of backwards reactionary interests that are probably for and against legalization. I mean, you know, bourgeois interests will line up in all sorts of ways depending on their specific position within the system.
Oh, sure.
And let's see. Well, and then that went down in, was it Uruguay, Paraguay, where they state created a state monopoly on marijuana and legalized it?
Oh, you know, I'm not familiar with that story so much, I don't think.
Okay. It's a few months old. But in any case, moving on, let's see, what else is going on in the world? There was that knife attack the other day in China, which kind of, you know, I always thought this is the weird, it seems like there's occasionally a knife attack in China, and, you know, you have, like, the kind of right-wing gun nuts who think or the people who think that if you take away guns, somehow violence will go away. I guess this would be the so-called left-wing gun nuts. But the kind of, you know, the liberal anti-gun sort of sentiment where it's, you know, get rid of guns and you can have, you know, people won't get shot, yada, yada, yada. But it just goes to show people always find a weapon. And I was wondering if you wanted to comment maybe, perhaps, on some of how, I guess, capitalism kind of engenders this sort of thing. I mean, it seems pretty senseless just looking at the headline. And I, you know, just heard a little bit of bits of information about it, but I was wondering if you'd just kind of comment about the kind of psychologies created by capitalism.
Oh, gosh. That seems like a whole nother show. that's a tough one. I mean, just to keep it, to keep things succinct, I think, you know, a system that's geared towards profitability over people are not going to prioritize the wealth and the system prioritizes wealth in a few hands, the health and the well-being of people. You know, once you have a socialist transition, you know, an attempted socialist transition towards communism, where from each according to their ability, to each according to their need, all over the planet, you know. Till then, we'll have a situation, you know, which we've nominally called socialism, where we put people ahead of profitability. And when that situation happens, I think we'll be able to handle a lot of the situations that lead to, you know, nasty antisocial behavior, murderous behavior. You know, we can get rid of, you know, the conditions that cause this type of antisocial behavior from happening. What you have in capitalist society is not an emphasis on the social, but an emphasis on the psychological, which is the classic bourgeois approach to antisocial problems. Is not look at what is happening in society generally, but take the psychological approach and isolate, you know, individuals, you know, and individual body minds. Try to tinker with stuff using drugs and whatever else. Yeah, and this kind of individualist bourgeois psychological approach, unfortunately, is too popular amongst, you know, the nominal left. I mean, even though they try to keep things social now and then, the way the left deals with a lot of interpersonal problems is still really much rooted in, you know, psychological based approaches, even though it's peppered with a bunch of attempts at, you know, ideology regarding sociology. It's still very individual based, and so I mean, it's even reproduced in radical spaces, I think, this sort of psychology.
I think it's fair to say that the kind of social system is kind of reflected in what might be called like an individual psychology, the kind of general disposition and manner that one goes about relating to other people. I definitely think, capitalism through alienating people from one another creates a situation where it's not as difficult, or it kind of engenders within people this condition that it's not as, it's fairly easy, I suppose, to go out and, you know, stab 29 people, or to kill 29 people that you don't know in a subway. And we're talking about kind of China here, which is like the epitome, you know, of kind of capitalism. The raw exploitation. It's not necessarily like here in the first world where it's all, you know, we all kind of to some extent get ours. I mean, some more than others and some people less than others. But, I do think there is a kind of distinct psychological qualities that are created by capitalism, and specifically by the alienation of people from one another through capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be kind of some of the root of that antisocial behavior that leads to, you know, random violence, whether in the U.S. or China.
It's interesting that you bring
course,
that
like,
up,
like
though.
Like you said, you know, it's like you have these people who are ticking time bombs, and of course everybody's too worried about meeting a quota or something like that to figure out what's wrong with somebody, you know. And of course you got a society where people just don't give up, don't care.
Yeah.
They have, you know, they're too worried about making their dollar, you know, making their boss a dollar or whatever. That seems to be the case in capitalism. It doesn't seem like it's going to be resolved either. I can imagine how it's, you know, only going to get worse to some extent.
It's interesting you bring that up about China, though. Being that China, today's China is, you know, the manufacturing center in many ways of global capitalism. there's actually some workplaces in China. Well, they're almost like the classic Henry Fordvilles or whatever they were called, where workers at Ford would all be gathered into these little
Levittown.
Levittown, that's what they were, yeah. We have a similar situation in China, but you have also a government, a state capitalist government that used to be socialist. You know, you used to understand Marxism. So they've taken what they've able to understand about Marxism and perfected that to be able to increase that type of social alienation. Alienation, we're talking about something a little bit different than the way Marx used it, but social alienation, alienating workers from one another, so they're not able to band together, develop relationships, and unite against the system. workers are kept in these Levittown situations, you know, bunkers basically, barracks, excuse me, and shifted from one to the other. I mean, you don't know your coworker's name. You only know their number, and they keep getting shifted around, you know. And so you never really get to know anybody. And then people are alienated in such a way and atomized. I mean, this is some of the work that, you know, that is some of the most exploited in the so-called People's Republic of China. And that exploitation is what keeps the first world going, I mean, thus far. I mean, another poke in the eye at those that say China is a big socialist country. You know, yeah, but China could single-handedly bring down the whole imperialist system, a big chunk of it, if they wanted to, being that they're the manufacturing center of it. But they continually choose not to and continually choose to, you know, enrich their own bourgeoisie at you know, by participating in the exploitation of the majority of their population, you know, for the benefit of their minority rich and our majority rich here in the first world. So it's interesting you bring that up about the roots of antisocial behavior. And that, you know, and with that you have, you know, extraordinary suicide rates as well. I mean, we hear about knife attacks killing 29 people at one time because it's sensational. You know, we don't.
Oh, certainly.
Suicides aren't that sensational as far as media goes. It's just another exploited worker in China killing themselves. You know what I mean? So there's that.
Yeah.
There's also
Well, what was it in China? They set up the nets around the tops of the factory, like around the edge of the factories, so that like if workers try to jump, they just like kind of get caught by the net and they wouldn't die. I mean, imagine how dreadful that would be. You know, that, you know, oftentimes, you know, you feel disempowered, and that choice of kind of suicide is like your only kind of form of agency, and to even be denied that is insane. And they're doing this, of course, in Californian prisons too, where they're force feeding prisoners.
We're on hunger strike and whatnot.
But let's kind of move on, because I don't want to, you know, talk about the world too much without talking about some of the solutions to all the shit going on.
Yeah, sure.
And I know you're doing a little bit of organizing in Seattle, anti-imperialist action.
Mm-hmm.
What's that all about?
Well, that's the thing. The organizing is definitely not centered around me or my work. I mean, it's actually work that other people have doing. I mean, all I did is basically give it a larger context to the global situation, which is really what's been lacking, I think, nowadays. The Occupy thing came and went, you know, and it was good for the fact of being, you know, not specifically, you know, anti-goals, so to speak, you know. So it was good in that sense, as being kind of slightly nihilistic in that sense, where
start funding like violent protesters to start like attacking cops or something like that. Anyways, I digress. making a point about Ukraine and everything. But going back, I'm sorry. Tell us more about what's going on and how you're kind of adding more context to what's already going on.
Yeah. What I'm doing with the anti-imperialist action is, well, antiimperialistaction.wordpress.com. It's just a basic WordPress page. I'm doing the journalistic work for it. It's things that are already going on. It's things like specifically in my situation locally. There's some things I highlight because these are things that help weaken the empire behind enemy lines, and practical things that people are doing. Anti-imperialist action is not an organization because, you know, it doesn't need to be. It's just action oriented. I mean, I'll leave it to others to actually be the organization. Capital O. what anti-imperialist action is precisely that, action. And the key part of that is, you know, organization is involved, but it's not capital O organization. It's lowercase O. It's coordination between these different groups who are objectively doing anti-imperialist action. And, you know, it's just kind of bringing things together to bring a larger context to what I think right now is, it's not the way Platypus describes things, you know, destroy the left because they suck. No, it's more like there's awesome things going on right now, but they don't have a consistent context to them, you know. Maybe for a brief moment we had, you know, some anarchist treatments on things which were more or less vague appeals to total freedom, or, you know, that kind of thing. And that's pretty good. That's a pretty good starting point. But I do see a kind of a frustration out there where people are wanting to flesh things out and find meaning in the particular thing they're good at doing. So I do like to bring it back to that, and that's why I started this journalistic project on antiimperialistaction.wordpress.com. And so I call the post that I have up there right now the Anti-Imperialist Action 5-Point Program to Destroy the Empire. You know, I make it provocative that way. But as I go through the 5 points, I mean, people can see what things they can plug into locally, or if they already are plugged into something, they can see, you know, all right, I'm doing something that objectively weakens the system. Oh, and that there's other people that are doing other things different than what I'm doing that are objectively weakening the system. You know, how can I help? Or it's just good to know that somebody else is handling another thing on their end of the organizing bit. But without further ado, this is the 5-point program to destroy the empire from Anti-Imperialist Action. Number one, do whatever necessary to defend the freedom of movement for migrants moving from the global south into the global north, as well as their ability to send resources back, aka remittances, to the global south. Erase the borders and tear down the walls. So to put point number one in the way that we as communists put it, you know, we who are you know, loosely affiliated or outright, you know, upholding of Maoism, third worldism, something that we have been advocates for, you know, sometimes we put it in crude terms of we've been advocates of the third world invading the first world. And oftentimes that's presented itself in the crude way of the Soviet Red Army invading Nazi Germany, you know, or the El Plan de San Diego, you know, or something like that, something rather provocative. But here's an example of an actual invasion of the first world by the third world, even though it's unconscious, even though it's basically migrant labor chasing around profits that were stolen from value that's been stolen from their own homeland. So they become economic refugees. And then so those of us in the global north that are making things easier for migrant labor without legal working rights in particular is objectively anti-imperialist action. It's objectively, you know, helping the third world within the first world, so to speak. So that's one area where I see people are doing some really good work in. Specifically right now, it didn't start this way with their overemphasis, I thought, with the port worker, longshoremen and whatnot, who as far as the international working class is concerned, we can call them a labor aristocracy, right? But you know, the Longshoremen's Union and whatnot. But rather, nowadays, the Seattle Solidarity Network is working with migrants nowadays, you know, helping them against their struggles against landlords and bosses who are cheating them and whatnot. So yeah, it's bourgeois democratic in its scope.
Definitely.
But can
I just jump in? Because people out there should definitely check out Seattle Solidarity Network. And I'm not, you know, going to give them a glowing endorsement in terms of all their goals and their politics. But
mm-hmm.
it's always blown my mind that they haven't gotten more positive press from the left, because they're essentially about what a lot of the left is about, and they're a really good example of, like, how to actually be effective in terms
yeah.
of, you know, if a landlord is, you know, trying to charge somebody a ridiculous amount for something that, you know, doesn't, you know, a damage or something like that, or somebody's basically stealing wages, they're very effective
mm-hmm.
at pressuring those landlords and bosses to cave in and, you know, either give up their claim against their tenant, or, you know, pay the wages that are owed to a you know, what's likely a former employee at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just always been stunning to me that, like, more of the, you know, the nominal left in the U.S. haven't paid more attention to what CSOL is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've met some, they're a very dedicated group of people, and, you know, I wish they'd be a little bit more theoretical and I guess not theoretical, but clear in their analysis of classes in the world and how their work is relating to that.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's the amazing thing about material reality being one of the best teachers, is that, you know, they got to the point where their main social base was third world workers, because they kept true in their practice to the notion of internationalism. You know, they didn't leave that behind. So they may have started out first worldist, but through their work in being consistent to what, you know, the whole wobbly ideal is about, you know, adjusted for the 21st century, where the majority of you know, the nominally exploited working class in this country, where it exists at all, are going to be, you know, in service industry, you know, other places, other parts of the economy where migrants are the chief, you know, labor pool, and find that as their social base. So that's the CSOL aspect is one aspect that I consider nowadays to be genuinely anti-imperialist action on point one. And then another group that's doing great work on a bourgeois democratic level in favor of free movement of migrants is a local group around here. Some of the Black Orchid Collective comrades are involved in it. It's called Who You Callin' Illegal? And they question mark afterwards. As in, who are you calling illegal, pilgrim? They're a group of folks who get together who prevent the deportations of migrants and detentions by Immigration Customs Enforcement, ICE. So it's everything from noise demos to actual concrete work, public relations work, to prevent families from being ripped apart by ICE. It started around work defending a local comrade from being deported back to her home country on the African continent, Didi, who interestingly enough joined me on the megaphone against some white nationalists back in May Day 2010. That was covered, as she was pregnant back then, and we covered that in a RAME Global Digest, an early manifestation of both RAME and its media back then. So things have, you know, it's interesting how you see some of the same people sometimes, you know, and you know, you have to show solidarity with them when the system comes down on them, because they're coming down on all of us in different ways, you know, where they can. But that covers point number one. Point number two, well, for now, point number two, do whatever necessary to interrupt the flow of value into the global north from the global south, or the realization of profits from the capitalist imperialist system. Do this through global general strikes and boycotts. So number two is something that people have been doing, although they can't do it all the time. It's different than the, you know, doing it by onesies and twosies with point number one in the work of Who You Callin' Illegal and CSOL. It's a little bit bigger. Not that CSOL hasn't been involved in number two type stuff, where we're talking about big general strikes and whatnot, but general strikes and boycotts, the more specific manifestation of those, at least locally, was the West Coast port shutdown. And the energy coming out of Occupy was a big factor in that. And, you know, it cost the system more than $1 billion worth of realized profit.
Hey, comrade.
Yeah.
Hey, we got about 2 minutes to go.
Oh, yikes. We are wrapping up. So, yeah, number three, do whatever necessary to prevent the recruitment of young people into the military, police, and correction officers, and encourage imperialist intelligence agencies, and prevent the also encourage those who are already in those positions to defect. Okay, so that's number three. That's something we haven't been doing. We should be doing more often. Number four, do whatever necessary to increase to create global public opinion for international intervention against Western imperialism. Cheer on and support the peoples of the world in breaking up the empire's chains upon them. That's what I do in All Power to the Positive .info with Sensei Gregory C. Lewis, is creating global public opinion. And number five, do whatever necessary to build and defend the independent institutions of the oppressed to replace the decaying empire. Show and prove that another world is possible. And we'll have to spend another show talking about number five, because the dual power subject is its own program, for sure.
All right. Well, whenever the show ends, stay on the line. We had somebody who wanted to ask us a couple questions. My messenger was down. I don't know what. I didn't see the producer's message. But, But thanks a lot for joining us. You know, it's been a hell of a show. Certainly discussed a lot of topics. I hope people found it informative, and, you know, definitely some controversial issues with Russia and everything. So hopefully we can have you on again. We can do the whole round-the-world thing again and talk a little bit more about what's going on in Seattle and Denver and all of that stuff.
Yeah, comrade, this was really great. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Man, I hope our listeners did too.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much. Stay on the line, and we'll catch everybody next week. Thanks so much.
All righty.